Mr. A.W. Phillips, Reel 2. You were just telling me, Mr. Phillips, about what the bayonet practice involved.
Oh, well, it was sacks suspended on poles, you know, and then we used to run forward, stab the sack, pull it out, and chase on to the next one, and stab that and pull it out. That was the...
Did you shout?
No, didn't need to shout at all. It was just the bayonet practice, which was similar to nearly all battalions did the same sort of thing.
What did the training involve when you were on these manoeuvres?
Well, there was, there was three other battalions there with us. There was the 1st Kent, the 1st Northern Hampshire, and the 1st 25th City of London. And we used to take it in turns of being the enemy and, trying to catch each other out. But at night, of course, it was rather difficult because the whole place, as you went out, looked well like one long desert, you know, flat desert. But then you've got these dongas in between where you had to be very careful of, falling over because they were pretty deep, like... Well, the valleys, really, and they call them dongas there. And then, of course, it was being so dark, you had to, coming back, you'd got to find your way back without compass, which was pretty difficult.
Did you ever have any accidents with these dongas?
No, I didn't hear of any, no. I think we did pretty well.
Whilst you were having these manoeuvres, did it involve any firing at all?
No, there's no blank ammunition or anything of that sort. It was just a case of finding the enemy, and I don't know how they judge the results, but we just did what we were told, and that was that. We try to find out where the enemy were, and that was all there was to it.
Did you find that this training effective in view of the operations you were engaged in later?
Well, not really, no, because the ground that we covered over eventually on the frontier was totally different to the ground we got here. I mean, whereas this was pretty well all sand and perfectly flat. Of course, when we got on the frontier, we found it was totally different. It was mountains and boulders and all the rest of it. But as I say, from there, you see, we did this march to it's supposed to have been to Seringapatam in the first place. The colonel had a difficulty to get permission for the battalion to go to Seringapatam, where he wanted to show us what the bayonet had done in capturing this city. And of course, when we got there after about 10 days, we found the breach in the wall was still there, where the troops had come across the curvy river, one mass of boulders, and had captured the city. And there was a memorial there, which is still there, I understand, to the troops that captured the city.
So your colonel wanted to take you there in order to show you
what the bayonet work could do.
I see.
That was the idea.
Because you were doing all this bayonet training.
That's right, yes.
To you, there didn't seem to be much point in it.
No.
How did he get permission for you to go there?
Because well...
it was Mysore was a native state, wasn't it?
We didn't... in the first place, as I say, it was supposed to be Seringapatam. But before we got there, there was a message came from the Miraj of Mysore to the colonel, inviting the whole of the battalion into the city on the following Monday. Well, we went in on the following Monday, that was the first time that the British troops had been into Mysore since its independence in 1981. So it was really quite an honour, really. And we had a marvellous time. I mean, the crowds welcomed us, and there's a lot of white people there as well, and all the flags are flying. And but the when we got the Mirage's bands were a much faster step than ours, and we were sweating by the time we got to Government House, where all the tents were put up for our convenience, you know, for the washing and whatnot, and also for your meals. And it was a really magnificent day. We had lunch at midday, and then he provided all sorts of conveyances for the troops to visit, you know, go around the city. The one that intrigued me was the two camels drawing this contraption, you know, to sit in and go round. Then there was the elephants. The fellows managed to climb up on those and explored the town. But I myself and some others stood there, and we thought there was plenty of conveyances to take us round, but we found that we were on our own eventually. Everybody had gone. So we went round to the palace stables and that, and examined the coaches and the horses, and you got some magnificent coaches there. And then to the zoo, and we really had a lovely time. In the evening, he inspected us on the parade ground, and that was something worth seeing, because he came up in his coach with some outriders, you know, and inspected us. And then from there, that was getting on towards evening, from there we marched to the palace. And marvel of marvels, he'd invited the battalion to fire through his palace. And we got there with powered arms, and as soon as we got to the palace itself, it was there was about 15,000 lights, all electric lights all over it. A marvellous sight. And as I say, we went through, and it was really outrageous to be walking over mosaic floors with army boots, you know. But
did you do any damage?
Well, I hope not. I didn't hear of anything being broken or anything at all. But as I say, it was magnificent inside. The ivory doors and silver doors, and we passed a beautiful music room with an organ and a piano there. Really, really magnificent place. I was told it took 9 years to build, but really marvellous.
Why do you think that the Maharaja of Mysore showed you such hospitality?
Well, I don't know, really, because I suppose it was just the fact that no British battalion had been in that direction for some years. I can imagine that was the only real reason.
How did your unit come to be there then?
Where?
Why was it that your unit had gone to Seringapatam in the first place?
Well, the whole battalion went.
But yes, you said that your colonel had got this permission for you to go.
Oh yes,
because he wanted to show you Seringapatam. Isn't there a story behind how he managed to get the permission? You found out later how he'd got the permission, didn't you?
Oh yes, yeah, but that's in the book.
Yes, well, tell us again.
Well, I don't know if I can explain it really. He had to go to the right to the top, and they refused in the first place, but How he got permission eventually, I just don't know.
Mm.
Because he was told that he wasn't to cause any trouble of any sort. And when it came to an invitation to go to Mysore, well, then he was in a bit of a fix, because it hadn't been the intention of the battalion to go to Mysore.
You hadn't got permission to go to Mysore. No, you only got permission to go to Seringapatam.
That's right, only Seringapatam. Mm. So that he was in a bit of a fix, but anyhow, he decided that he'd had to go, because I'll say the Maharaja was a big man, and therefore he should be obeyed.
He'd be causing trouble if he didn't go.
Yes, oh yes, yeah.
So he'd be disobeying orders.
That's
if
right.
He didn't go.
Oh yes. Oh, the marvellous day though.
Can you tell us about a bit more about your visit to Seringapatam? You saw this place where the breach had been made.
Of course, when we went in, it's a tremendous fort, you know. A wall all the way round, and you go into through a big archway with running water underneath. And when you go in, you're really staggered at the size of the place, because you can't imagine a place like that being walled in. And as I say, the breach of the wall was still there, evidently left as a memorial of some sort, because it was Tipu Sultan that they defeated eventually, because I mean he defeated the British in 1792 and 4, and we beat him eventually in 1799. And there's a museum there which we were able to have a look at during the day. A really magnificent building, but as I say, we went in and we were really surprised at the size of the place. And I went up with some others into one of the mosque towers. You know, they got these big towers right up, and we got a marvellous view of the city from the top. But the thing that surprised me most was when we came away, there was a fellow who'd got a cannonball. And I said to him, I said, where did you get that from? So he said, oh, he said, I dug it out of the wall of the city, you see. So I couldn't hardly believe it, because, I mean, it was a straight wall. You could see the cannonball marks, but it was a perfectly straight wall. And, of course, at the bottom, it was nothing else but mud and water. Anyhow, he'd got this, and as I say, I don't know whether his parents had anything to do with any museum in England, but he said it was going to a museum in England. So whether it ever eventually got to a museum in England or not, I don't know. But his name, I should like to record, was Mr. Von der Heide, Private Von der Heide, which, of course, is a name in Brighton, I found out recently. And whether it is an interview him or not, I'd like to, you know, find out.
So he'd really perform some acrobatic feat in order.
Well, he
to
must
be
have done, because
I can't
see how he got it myself. Because I've got a photograph that shows the cannonball pop marks of the straight wall, which you've seen.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so this was the officer who was responsible for organising this trip was called what? Called who?
Oh, I don't remember that. You mean organising the trip? Oh, Lieutenant Colonel Johnson.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yes. He was a very forceful man. I mean, although he was forceful, I think we'd have followed him anyway, you know. He'd been in the Jameson Raid in South Africa, so you can guess he was pretty forceful. But we got on very well with him. And I think he did the best for the men, you know, let them see as much of India as they possibly could. Which comes to the 7-day train ride, from Bangalore up north, 2,300 miles. And when we got to Agra, he stopped the train, got us all out, and with the band we marched to that Taj Mahal. Another beautiful building. You see, he was a fellow that, although he was very strict, he was a fellow that wanted us to see as much of India as we possibly could. He was a really decent sort.
Did the rest of the troops in his unit respect him?
Oh, yes, I think so. Oh, yes, I never heard any complaints against him. He was a jovial sort of fellow. As I say, when he was on with the front, he said, we were laying down pretty, tired. And he said, when my horse is tired, he said, oh, no, you're tired. But we didn't take offence at it, because a horse is more of a, more staying power than we've got. So that we only really smiled at it, in a sense.
Can you remember any of the other officers that you had in India besides Colonel Johnson?
Our own officers, you mean? Mm. Well, there was Adjutant Captain Hines. There was Captain Hines. Captain Brown. I can't remember my own officer. Hmm. That's funny.
What did the men think of these other officers?
They respected them. They, did what they were told. I don't know that anybody was ever objectionable or anything. We got on very well together, the men and the officers.
So you never felt that you had bad officers in India?
Oh, no. Oh, no. No.
Could we come back to something you said earlier about training? You said that type of training you were having around about Bangalore wasn't really of very much use to you when you went up into the frontier you're up in the mountains.
That's right.
Does that mean that you never had any mountain training whilst you're in India?
No, we didn't have any. No mountain training in India. No, none at all. We had it mostly at, as I say, in this country, at Chiltern near Swindon, with all the mud and stuff that we had there. That was really the only extensive mounted warfare that we had.
In England,
before you went? Yes, yes.
Did you find that of use to you on the frontier?
Well, no, not really, because the frontier is a place on its own. You can't... You can't find another place in the country that's like it, that you could train on that extent, because, as I say, it's all mountains and nothing else but boulders and stones. But
in your training periods, was there any cooperation with Indian Army units?
Up on the frontier, oh yes, we had the Gurkhas and the Sikh Mounted Battery. And the Camel Corps men. And we got on very well with the Gurkhas. They were nice little fellas. It was always Johnny with them on, us and them Johnny. And very nice fellas.
Why did you like them?
Well, I don't know. I think we respected them because we knew they were jolly good fighters. They were really... tough, and we got on very well with it. I don't know why. It's just that one of those things. We didn't see very much of the Sikh Mounted Battery. They were pretty well on their own. But
you were telling me about an incident in which a Gurkha soldier.
Oh yes, of course, up on the front there we had very little to eat, really. I mean, all we got was army biscuits and water. And sometimes in the evening we'd have bully beef and stew and potatoes. But I know one evening the thing was a bit quiet. We went over to the Gurkha lines and there's one fella there, he's got this chapati cooking. And we, of course, stood there and looked at it. He said, presently, he says. So when he'd finished, he gave it to us. And, you know, we thanked him for it and started walking away. And he said, nice hub. Pointing to another one he was doing, you see. So we stood there, and when that was finished, he gave us that one as well. And the only reward we could give him was the last three cigarettes we got between us. But it just shows the attitude that they... Of course, they were better off, really, for food than we were, because they had an allowance of flour and stuff, you see, that they could cook whenever they felt felt inclined, or there was time to do that sort of thing, whereas we had to put up with what our cook could rake up for us. So that was why, I suppose, that I got a poisoned arm eventually, because the blood wasn't too good.
You were run down.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So the British troops never did any cooking themselves, like the Gurkhas. You said the Gurkhas cooked their own chapatis.
Oh, yes.
But the British troops never did any of that type of thing.
Not on their own, oh no. Oh no, it was...
All the cooking was done by the army cooks.
Done by the army cooks, oh yes, yeah.
You said that the British troops got on very well with the Gurkhas.
Mm-hmm.
Did they get on all right with the other Indian troops?
As far as I know, there was never seemed to be any animosity anywhere. Of course, as we camped overnight, we were we weren't mixed up. I mean, the Gurkhas were in their part of the camp, and we were in our part of the camp. And as I say, we didn't mix. Well, it wasn't necessary really to mix too much.
Could we come on to the details of the campaigns that you engaged in on the frontier? How many campaigns did you have there?
Oh, we went up to the frontier twice. We went up by train at one stage, and they dropped us almost in the desert, and that was in the evening. And then from there we marched over the River Indus on a pontoon bridge about a mile across, and finished up at a place called Dera Ismail Khan. Well, we stayed there for the night.
When was this? Which year?
16. Mm-hmm. 16. And from there the next morning we marched on to a place called Tank. That was another walled city. But I didn't go in there. I'd seen enough of some of these towns.
What was wrong with Dera Ismail Khan? What was wrong with Dera Ismail Khan?
Oh, well, we were glad to get out of it because the sewage system wasn't all that too good. We were glad to get away from it eventually.
Did it stink?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But as I say, we got a tank, and then we stayed there for a couple of days, for a clean-up and that. And then we marched 14 miles to Jatta Fort, right close to the frontier. And there we stayed for about 2 months, I think it was. And we found eventually that we were, what word do I want now? We were in reserve. We were in reserve to a column that had gone into the mountains, but we weren't evidently weren't needed. And as I say, after 2 months, we went away to Fraser Poor, and that was a tremendously hot place.
This was in the Punjab. Fraser Poor.
That's right, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
What month were you there then, in this hot weather? What month was it?
Somewhere about February, I should think. February, March. And, but from there, of course, we went to the frontier again after out about a couple of months.
Which year would that be?
Well, it was 17.
Can you tell me 17. About that second trip to the frontier?
Well, that was... we went to Fraserpore, we went up to... we went up by train again, and we crossed the Indus, this time on paddle steamers. And that took us to... across again to Tank, where we'd been before. And, as I say, it was a bit of a forced march there, to get there. And when we got there, it started raining, but we were so fed up, we just laid down and, as we were, and went to sleep. And the next day we started off on this air adventure. This was to be an adventure too.
Did you sleep on the ground?
Oh, yes, yes. Oh, yes, sleep on the ground. In your uniform, with all your ammunition, hang around your neck.
As a precaution against it being stolen.
That's right, yeah. And your gun down beside you.
Did anybody get their weapon or ammunition stolen?
Not to my knowledge, no. No.
So where did you go after you that night at Tank?
From Tank, we started off, and we went up the... what's the name of that river now? The Zab River, it was. And we had to cross it. It's about half a mile wide, and the river zigzagged down the pass. And I think we crossed that river about 30 times the first day. Most of the fellas had taken off their putties. They were sensible, but... as I say, I kept mine on, and not being sensible. And the weight of the water and the putties, of course, nearly killed me. It was terrible. And my body was so ready to go forward, but my legs were just a nuisance. So I finished up under, I think, about the only tree we saw that day, and there was about 20 others under there. All just about done up, and we made.